Leaving Denton for Good, Part 4. Norman Ralston was generous enough to invite me down to the new North-South Macrobiotic Center's East Dallas location to help set it up, which I eagerly accepted. There was a two-bedroom apartment above the barn which was more comfortable than my Denton home. I was able to paint, scrape, and clean some of the property, but my condition was worsening, and soon I could not trust myself on a ladder. Some days, riding in a car was not possible, as my neck could not withstand any motion. Norman demonstrated his healing skill in massage by working on me many times, but I was in such bad shape from this mysterious ailment that the slightest touch would be agonizing. My spine was 2 inches off to one side in the small of my back. I thought I had kidney problems due to pain there, but that was mistaken. Getting out of bed could take as long as 20 minutes. I never considered conventional medical diagnosis or treatment, but macrobiotics wasn't working, and I had no idea what the disease was. This drove me to the point of considering suicide. Anshul Brusiloff had promised me, since I'd started writing my Symphony No. 1 for him the previous May, that the NTSU orchestra would play through the work. However, he put it off again and again until there was only one more week of orchestral rehearsals. He reassured me that the orchestra would read through it, and on Saturday he wanted me to phone his office on Monday morning to work out details. When I called, his assistant told me there were no more rehearsals and that Anshul wouldn't be in until the afternoon. Finally, I realized I was being toyed with and deceived. I sent him a letter saying I would like very much to work with him in the future, but he would have to get in touch with me as I would no longer bother him as I had in the past. I stuck to my guns for a couple of years. People looked to Anshul to see what his reaction to my music would be. Since he rejected my work, everyone else did too. Any musical opportunities for me in Denton were finished, and I had no other leads. In early June, Herman and Cornelia Ihara came to visit our center from California, accompanied by Carl Ferrey, an old friend from Denton. Herman was far more relaxed than the Boston leaders, to the point of hardly being able to give a talk. He got up and said, "Any questions?" Cornelia, on the other hand, was quite the battle axe, or should I say, Nagatana. Her cooking was so salty that my jaw swelled and I couldn't fully close my mouth. When I used ground sesame seeds without salt as a condiment, she cackled and ridiculed me at length for being different. I was not amused. During their visit, I performed one of my solo violin sonatas, which was quickly forgotten. Next time, I'll play before we eat. In late June, we had Stephen Upperchard come down from Boston, quite the opposite from Herman. Stephen retired from a job in the Pentagon, devising targeting strategies for nuclear warheads. Now he ran a study house where people coming to learn about macrobiotics could rent a room and share meals, which had about the same kind of vibe as his old job. From my extremely meager personal funds, I ran off flyers for his visit and paid for the stamps, plus put in hours phoning anyone who might be interested. Stephen sat me down and scolded me for not doing a better job with slicker and more expensive advertising. Deep inside, I wanted to tell him that he was a sorry sack of miso, but for some reason, I just took the abuse. My spine was weak. People were so uninspired by our visitors that no one came to cooking classes or any other events afterwards. The best we could manage was occasional potlucks. My health improved somewhat over the summer so that I was ambulatory and could ride in cars. The hot weather helped as well. After some external treatments with sesame oil and ginger juice, I was fit enough to take a little jog around our block. In our neighborhood, each house had a yard. Each yard had a tall chain-link fence, and every fence held a vicious dog at bay, which would lunge and howl at anyone walking or jogging down the street. Welcome to Friendly Dallas. This was the last time I would ever run. The heat inspired my customary flight north for the summer on July 4th, when I boarded the dreaded bus for the 3-day trip to my dad's home. He asked me to lend him my electric piano, and he would pay to have it shipped up from Dallas. However, there was a criminal element in the cargo department, and they stole my piano, stopping my efforts at composition for a year. After seeing Dad, I visited Anton, who was renting and caretaking 740 acres in eastern Maine, just across the border from Mount Washington. This was near the little town of Brownfield, where Philo T. Farnsworth had lived. Farnsworth became a hero of mine some time later. He was the inventor of electronic television, as well as inertial electrostatic confinement for tabletop-scale nuclear fusion. On this farm was a dilapidated and vandalized hunting cabin, fit only for summer use, and a 10-acre lake. I was delighted by the natural beauty and wildness. Anton was getting its use so cheaply that he offered to let me stay there whenever I liked. But that was only possible during the warm season, which was quite short in those parts. There was a small mountain on the property and some superb firewood. The cabin was 2 miles from the paved road and nearest neighbor. We had no electricity, phone, or any other utilities, and it was 7 miles to the mailbox. There was a well uphill and a pipe 4 feet underground to the cabin that gave running water quite the luxury. I used my quiet time here in the heavy theoretical work of my pseudoscientific cosmology, banging the life out of my calculator. Passing through Boston, I attended the first North American Macrobiotic Congress, since, like most cults, we were preparing for the day we had global power. I showed the early results of my wave matrix work to Michaud and asked his advice. He mumbled something about logarithmic spirals. There was a little talent show at the end of the Congress. I decided to write something that could be performed on short notice by just about anyone who could read a little music. The result was Little Miss Nonfat for 4 speakers, modeled after the marvelous Geographical Fugue by Ernst Toch. I found 1 woman who could read rhythms, and we tried out the top 2 parts outside on the lawn. After going through it, she said, "It's too good. We can't perform this. We might ruin it." I responded, "I can always make it worse so that we can play it. What do you recommend?" That was the end of that. I returned to Dallas in mid-September and noticed that the bus people had taken my inflatable kayak, which I had brought along with me. As a result, I was down to clothes, a few books, my own music, and my violin. Plus, I had lost 15 pounds during the trip. Norman gave me a part-time job at his veterinary clinic. Here I could see real results. There is no placebo effect with animals. They don't get better because they believe in the power of a treatment. Pets came in sick from eating what their masters gave them, and very frequently with the same diseases as their owners. In fact, we used the health of the humans to help diagnose the pets. We changed the animal's diet and saw them get better in 10 days. It was quite powerful and impressive. I cooked for the dogs and cats in our kennel. We did a lot of acupuncture using traditional needles, electroacupuncture, and moxibustion. This was particularly dramatic in cases of paralysis. One day, a dog came in dragging its hind legs. We had the owners wait out front while we consulted our acupuncture charts, which are dizzyingly complex. After insertion of the needles, we applied the voltage, and sure enough, the back legs came up. But for some unknown reason, the front legs went down. So we had to stall the owners a while to figure out what went wrong. We got all four legs in operation by the end of the afternoon. After seeing that kind of thing day after day, I was sold on the power of what we were doing, but I saw real deficiencies in the traditional theory behind the effects. We would be unlikely to improve that situation without a device that could interact with ki, or as I preferred to call it, prana, that flowed through the body. That's why I wanted to build the oracle. Norman hired two veterinarians to help with this practice. One was Hugh Weir, who I respected a lot. He went on to run a non-profit animal protection organization in New Mexico for 20 years and did acupuncture for racehorses. Norman and Hugh were not the put-on-a-show, collect-the-dough-let-em-go kind of medicine men I'd seen so many times. I did grunt work during some surgeries and was duly impressed. Norman and Hugh, in typical Texas A&M graduate style, said, "It's time to get you bred." But no prospects appeared. I called up the ISKCON Temple in Dallas and asked for Dorothy. The Prabhu, who answered the phone, said, "She is taking sleep." I said, "She's what?" He said, "She's sleeping," with that disgusted, "What a carmy," tone of voice. I set up a time we could come visit, and shortly afterwards, Norman and I drove down there. She was all decked out in a fine sari and long red pigtails, clearly enjoying herself. We weren't allowed to talk to her alone, and there were several male devotees hovering around. She was a new convert, and they wanted to make sure she stayed converted. Plus, she was very attractive, and I'm sure these brahmacharis, or celibate devotees, were feeling the heat. As we talked, the devotees became more and more upset. Dorothy insists I said, "Food is God," but I doubt it since I never thought so. We encouraged her to think for herself, and in short order, her minders got very angry and started shouting at us. It was time to leave. Dorothy had never seen her fellow devotees lose their tempers before. This was not the last time. That fall, I wrote a truly terrible book. It's all done with mirrors. The first part was a compilation of past life readings with various people, and the second part was the first attempt at the autobiography. The whole mess was almost unreadable with its constant ranting about the order of the universe and macrobiotic bourgeois. I convinced Terence with some difficulty that this qualified as a community project for the food store and got $500 from the store funds to print 300 copies. I mailed and gave away a dozen or so, with the rest moldering in a trunk. Eventually, I disposed of them. Some time later, I hunted down people who retained copies and implored them to throw their copy away. The book infuriated many friends and family members, and some musicians as well. The damage from distributing even a few copies lasted many years. Randy joined me in the apartment above the barn, enjoying the free rent in return for pitching in. By December, it was clear that the North-South Center lacked community interest and was not going to work. Norman was in the mood to start charging rent. I was keen on going to a macrobiotic study house in Boston anyway, and Randy decided that only free rent would keep him in the desolation of Far East Dallas, next door to the auto-crushing yard and a couple blocks away from scenic Balch Springs. So, late in the year, I got once again on the Greyhound and landed in Jamaica Plain to live in the study house of Rob and Kit Allenson. Intensive cult training, winter 1979-80. From my work at the vet clinic and by spending almost nothing, I had saved up about $500. At the study house, I paid about $200 a month for a small room and board. After some time, I had to move up to the attic, which I shared with two others, and had a space about 8 feet by 6 feet for my own. Many evenings, I would go to the East-West Center and attend macrobiotic functions. To sustain this, I needed to work as much as possible. My first hope was employment on the staff of the East-West Journal, the main macrobiotic publication. I arrived with samples of my North-South Journal from Texas and my new book. The staff were chain-smoking, coffee-guzzling, weak, skinny, white urban guys, guilty about being Caucasian and fantasizing about some ideal rural lifestyle. They wanted no part of me, especially as I was eager to join them. Another possible job was at Erewhon, the food company founded by the Cushies. I went down to the warehouse and saw the personnel manager. As soon as I said I was macrobiotic, she rolled her eyes and thought, "Oh no, another one." She really didn't want someone interested in saving the world and living in harmony with nature and spreading peace and health through food. Those folks were tired all the time and spaced out. She needed someone who ate meat and could work all day and get things done. In this land of the Yankees, she needed someone with actual yang ki. Having macros work there already put them on the verge of bankruptcy. After all my education, my only employable skill was touch typing, which I taught myself at age 12. So I went to a firm that specialized in temporary office work downtown. Companies typically used the temporary employees to try them out for possible long-term employment. So every assignment started off as a prospective permanent job. They gave me some classes in 10-key for data entry and other soul-killing secretarial skills, and set me loose on the financial district. I managed to find a spot in the accounting department of Peter Bent Brigham Hospital. Standard joke. Guy gets in a taxi, says, "Take me to the hospital." Driver says, "Peter Bent?" Guy says, "None of your damn business." To not go insane from the tedium and to keep my body moving, I would do exercises during coffee breaks where no one could see me. This was just too strange for my boss, and after 2 weeks, he fired me. While drifting in and out of employment, I set up shop in the basement to start construction of the Oracle. The design was formidable, but this was a low-budget approach in the extreme. The biggest part of the device was an 11-foot antenna that had to fit inside an octahedral orgone box with 72 layers of alternating conductor and insulator. That meant each of the 8 equilateral triangular faces of the box had to be 8 feet on a side. I set up a ping-pong table and made triangles out of cardboard and started layering with newsprint and aluminum foil. After a month of work on this and other components, such as 7,000-turn mercury core electromagnets, I realized the scale required for this device was enormous and far beyond what I could do at the moment. So I moved on to something even less practical. Macrobiotic theory included the work of Louis Kervran in Biological Transmutation, which asserted that organisms can change one element into another. It was impossible to justify the extreme forms of the diet without allowing our bodies to create critical elements missing in the food. I decided to put this to the test, not quite appreciating that experiments were frowned upon in macrobiotic circles. The idea was to expose carbon dust made from carbonized grains to a series of arcs, then test to see if the carbon had changed to any other elements. If the teachings of the dear leader were correct, we'd soon see. I made a series of slanted transparent tubes, at first plastic and then Pyrex, that vibrated from an eccentric motor drive. This allowed passage of carbon dust from the top through the tubes, which had rows of spark gaps about half an inch wide. I had stacks of automobile spark coils running off 110 AC, giving me several tens of thousands of volts. The grain had to be roasted thoroughly, which took a lot of oven time. I had to get up in the pre-dawn hours when the stove was not being used. One day I put trays of rice in the oven, cranked it up, and went back to bed. Unfortunately, I fell asleep and woke up to the smell of smoke. I went down to the kitchen, opened up the stove, and it belched forth flames. I put out the fire and was mopping things up when two burly firemen showed up due to a neighbor's call. It took a couple of weeks of wages to pay for the damages. In the end, there was no sign of transmutation, but I did get a fondness for high voltages that stuck with me through the years. Failure of the experiment made no difference to the party line on transmutation. Making this gear for bottom dollar meant several trips to a bulk wire warehouse in a rough part of town, requiring a walk through Roxbury. One day on this trip, there was only one other person in sight, a 10-year-old black boy dressed like a pimp, with a wide-brim hat, bell-bottom pants, and a lot of jewelry. He came up to me and said something entirely incomprehensible. I said, "Pardon?" reflexively, just as I would at Andover, before reflecting that this would be somewhat out of place. "Pardon," he said mockingly back at me, then more clearly this time, "do you have a big dick?" I was rather taken aback and responded that I supposed it was large enough for the duties it had to perform, and walked hurriedly on to the wire store. I could only play violin from time to time due to neck pain. In January, I rehearsed a Handel sonata for violin and piano with Lily Cushy, Michio's daughter, who was a fine pianist. Sadly, in 1995, she died of cervical cancer at age 41, after which Michio blamed her for eating poorly and getting medical treatments. In mid-January, I tried busking in the Boston subway during lunch for an hour and made $4. I gave a little concert for people from nearby study houses, but the noise level in the background was impossible to penetrate. People just didn't give a damn about my music, and I was tired of forcing the issue. I tried qualifying to be a taxi driver, which many residents of study houses had done. There's stories of violence and robberies by black men, including one friend whose throat was cut, did not dissuade me. I was a tough guy, used to eating macrobiotic bread. Besides, as an enlightened liberal, I could relate equally well to people of all backgrounds who were all the same fundamentally, or so the story went. The only problem was my chronic and lifelong inability to navigate. I studied the convoluted Boston street maps for a week before the Hackney carriage license test. Most of my competitors had lived on these streets their whole lives. Not surprisingly, and as a blessing from the universe, I failed. My next employment was at Blue Cross Blue Shield, punching and adding machine into submission. Our study house was 4 miles from the financial district downtown, and the subway cars took about 50 minutes to get there, if nothing went wrong. The commute was slower than it had been 100 years ago. A winter evening in the dark, the motor caught fire, which was not surprising since the car was manufactured during the Depression. That was a lot longer ride. My boss was drunk all day, and I sometimes envied him. Self-medication of the obliterating sort was an effective adaptive mechanism that was unavailable to me. I had to do each sum of perhaps 100 numbers with every keystroke perfect, or I had to do it all over again. There was no mechanism for correcting errors, which certainly sounded like an error needing correcting. After a couple of weeks, I said, "Screw this noise," and simply put in pencil corrections on the paper tape. The boss saw this and flipped out. End of that job. Terence and Gwen arrived in early February for a week's visit and brought the last of my meager possessions up from Texas. Everyone in the study house, Terence and Gwen included, came down with a bad cold. Macrobiotic theory said this couldn't happen. I had just started a new office job and had worked one day when I had to leave halfway through the next, which was a Friday. The following Monday, I worked 5 hours before having to leave due to sickness, and was immediately fired and replaced. Rob Allinson, who ran the study house with his wife Kit, had been a husky and hearty hockey player, but through the wonders of macrobiotics, was now an emaciated smoker. Eating at the study house was a unique experience. The table was very low to the ground, Japanese style. We were expected to sit on our heels, which my arthritis made excruciating. I used a little Seiza bench that raised me up a couple of inches and allowed me to sit almost like everyone else. I was severely criticized for this sign of weakness and nonconformity. Everyone else used only chopsticks, but I liked having a wooden spoon as well. This was always a cause of ridicule. The cooking relied on beans for our protein, but I couldn't digest them as they were cooked. I was frequently incapacitated with severe gas pain, sometimes having to miss work. It turns out that the almost total lack of saturated fat was damaging my intestines, and yet I remained a true believer. With my continuing health issues and a superabundance of macrobiotic advisors, I got a very long list of advice. Herman Ihara, back in Dallas, told me I should eat no animal food. Michio said I should eat fish 3 or 4 times a week. I was told to eat more salt, less salt, live in the north, live in the south, quit music, do more music, eat adoki beans, avoid adoki beans, you're too yin, you're too yang, you're too yin and yang, you eat too strictly, you eat too widely, drink more water, drink less water, eat salads, cook all your food, and so forth. And yet, I remained a true believer. I was deeply impressed by Masanobu Fukuoka's seminal book, One Straw Revolution, about natural farming techniques. I had just missed his first trip outside Japan when he came through Boston the previous summer. He was highly trained in agricultural science and applied his ideas to his family farm with remarkable results. Afterward, he went all around the world spreading his knowledge and helping to reclaim barren and abused land. This was the kind of spiritual, practical, humble, non-dogmatic action I was looking for. One couple took his message to heart, along with other influences from the Back to the Land movement, and went off to the wilds of British Columbia to homestead in the woods. they cleared some land, built a cabin, and toughed it out. As it was dead of winter, they came to Boston to give a talk to other macros. I was much impressed by their tenacity and ingenuity, and also by the reaction of the crowd, all of whom had clearly never been to a farm. This is where coming from Texas was an advantage. After all, Denton was the home of the American Donkey and Mule Society. Everybody wanted to hear about the bears, how the bears walked through the property. Were they afraid of the bears? Did the bears pound at their doors? Did they hear the bears howl at night? I think they had all grown up watching Yogi Bear on Saturday mornings. Being a wise ass, I asked, "What about cows?" The speaker grimaced. There were many snickers and comments from the crowd. How stupid that was! Cows out in the woods. They don't have cows in British Columbia. Who does he think he is? But in fact, they had a neighbor who had cows that got loose from time to time and played hell with their garden, and the speaker had to explain a little about reality to the city slickers. Naturally, I became even more unpopular, but some things are worth it. My next hell job was in the heart of Roxbury, typing up reports from visiting nurses. Michaud talked about the legendary inventor of the yin-yang philosophy, Fu Xi, and how his name is used in a Japanese version of pranayama. The out-breath is Fu, and the in-breath is a hissing Si through clenched teeth. I adopted this into a very powerful pranayama technique I had done for some time, using sharp, quick breaths called bostrika, ending with Fu Si, and then held for some time, sequentially on all seven chakras. As the subway ride to work was a long, useless waste of time, I did this bostrika while wearing a ski mask to remain inconspicuous. Of course I wasn't, but the other riders took most things in stride. One day I wished they hadn't been so jaded. At one stop, four young teenagers got on the car, one black and the others Hispanic. Two of the Hispanics held the third against one of the poles, and the black youth pummeled him in the guts. When they were through, they got off at the next stop. The other riders said and did nothing. I was fired after a couple of weeks as usual, and on March 10th started a new and ostensibly permanent job with AT&T on the 13th floor of their 18-floor building in the financial district. Dad was delighted. He was hoping I would spend the rest of my career in that building, grinding my soul into small, easily digested pieces, just as had happened with him in the machine shop. His own release came only 3 days later, at his 65th birthday. He immediately sold all of his tools and never looked back. I worked with a dozen overweight, depressed women and had a woman as my boss, but as usual, all the higher officers were men. We all could have been replaced by one person with an Apple II computer, but we had a union and worked for a monopoly. Nowadays, technology and the social structure are more efficient in concentrating wealth, and those jobs are long gone, along with Ma Bell. The work was not hard, just the usual menial tedium, with the perk of free phone calls. They gave me a sheet of paper with a list of trunk lines that needed periodic checking. I would send out tapes to each station in turn, and the whole cycle would take a couple of months. Fine. What they didn't mention was that I was to start halfway down the page. I started at the top. This meant that everything I did during my 6 weeks was worthless. One day in the bowels of the subway, I noticed that the first car was empty, even during rush hour. We all clambered aboard, taking advantage of this oddity. Almost immediately, after the doors closed and we started down the track, all the people from the front rushed to the back and on into the next car with horrified expressions. I was halfway down the car and wondered what the problem was. Suddenly, it was apparent. A homeless man slumped unconscious in his seat in the front next to the most unfortunate driver. Evidently, he took a dump in his pants some time before and gave it a chance to ripen. The stench was overwhelming. I joined the exodus. Now I knew how to have a subway car all to myself. Being a single man out in the world, I would often find a woman attractive and try to strike up a friendship. On a few occasions, this went all the way to sharing a lunch. But I was arthritic, dogmatic, and poor, and invariably women could find men healthier, easier to get along with, and richer. One woman who was very dear to me, intelligent, cultured, and creative, but far out of my class, had just moved to Boston. I met her when she was at Abbott, and I was at Andover, and visited her in Denver during my high-altitude summer, and again when she visited Dad and me in Peabody in 1975. She had an impressive apartment on Beacon Hill, and she introduced me to the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, a place that suited her sense of whimsy. After reading my first autobiography, she was grateful that I didn't include her, and so I won't mention her here either. I was desperate to find another way to live. After being trapped in the city since December, I was starved for nature. There was a macrobiotic farm in western Massachusetts, but they wanted someone who could man a big chainsaw all day. So I made plans to move to the wilds of Maine at the property Anton rented, where I could try natural agriculture and harvesting wild plants while working on the wave matrix theory. I had done some foraging in Texas, but needed to learn about plants in New England. To prepare, I took a course with Ken Burns, who ran another macrobiotic study house. He was an expert on wild food. After some classroom time, we stashed digging tools under our coats and headed for the subways. It's a good thing the officials didn't see our grub hoes and pitchforks with sawn-off handles, or we would have been arrested as terrorists. Ken's jaunty black beret helped set the mood of underground resistance. It was astonishing how many edible plants we could find in the parks and overgrown lots. But Ken said it took about a year to adapt to eating a substantial fraction of wild food in the diet. In fact, he reported what he called wild food psychosis when residents of his study house ate too much wild food too soon. Ken and his wife had big bags under their eyes. In the early days, Ozawa advocated the use of raw gray sea salt, which includes magnesium salts and other impurities. The result was permanent kidney damage among many of his followers, hence the eye bags. Ken died of cancer, and afterwards I heard that this was because he'd been a heroin addict or an alcoholic. I thought Ken was a very intelligent and articulate fellow and saw no sign of any impairment. There was no compassion in macrobiotics. He had to be at fault, or the doctrine would be invalidated. Peter Fernberger joined me on Patriots Day in the crowd near the finish line of the Boston Marathon. Pete was delivering yachts for a living, which for me was the dream job to end all dream jobs. Anton wanted to start Cargo Cult Incorporated to haul frozen fish from Martha's Vineyard to New Bedford and cordwood back to the island in a large sailing boat. Pete thought Anton was nuts and wanted nothing to do with him, but then Pete always had more sense than me. We watched Bill Rogers win his third marathon in a row. Then along came a woman, flailing her arms in extreme exhaustion, but sweat-free and with flabby thighs, unlike the other leading runners. She won the women's race, perked up right quick, and stood on the podium. Turns out Rosie Ruiz had cut out of the race early, rode the subway, got back in half a mile from the finish, and faked being tired. A heroine for our times. Appalachian Spring, 1980. At the end of April, I bought a cheap wall tent, packed up, and moved to Brownfield. Anton helped with transportation and most of the odd necessities to get the place livable. He stayed at the farm from time to time. Over the winter, a hermit had squatted in the hunting cabin, and our first duty was to clean up the mess. He left a sheet metal wood stove, which would tide us over until we got a better one. There was a large hole burned in the floor in front of the stove, many broken windows, and his pile of girly magazines, unfortunately used and of low quality. I pitched my tent nearby and put cardboard on the floor to withstand daily use. My Osmoroid fountain pen, used for copying music and writing, was lost in the move from Texas. My replacement pen still couldn't spell and used too many words. Previous tenants had attempted conventional gardening in the thin soil, which made the soil even worse. I brought seeds from Boston for both cultivated and wild plants. I thought I could dig narrow trenches in the sod, plant seeds, and put mulch on the grass between the trenches, thus avoiding the dreaded plow. I quickly gave this up and hired a man to till the garden. Fukuoka's methods required a lot of knowledge of agriculture plus his specific training, of which I only knew what I read. I got quite a bit of food from foraging, but most of what I ate came from bags of grains and beans. Much of the wild greens had high levels of oxalic acid, which were not good for my condition. I devised ways of using my pressure cooker to eat wild carrots and burdock, otherwise far too hardened by age to eat. Also, I ground wild seeds to put in bread that I also pressure cooked. Times were fat during blueberry season. That was when the bear turds turned blue, so we knew we had competition. 2 weeks into May, black fly season started in earnest. These little bastards kept the woods free from settlement. The bites are much more painful than for mosquitoes, and for dramatic effect, they bleed. I couldn't expose any flesh for 2 months. Bug dope just let them know where you were. I clipped 2 sticks of incense on the bill of my hat to generate a portable smoke screen. At dusk, these appeared to be 2 glowing red alien eyes that drove any visiting dogs insane. There were trout in our little pond, and thousands of very loud frogs. One day, a great blue heron showed up, and after 3 weeks, the pond was silent. This was the last year for any fish in the pond due to acid rain. We decided to make major improvements on the cabin so that staying the winter would be an option. We glassed in the former porch, put new asphalt shingles on the roof, added insulation, and a new vertical stovepipe. In December, we brought in a cast-iron airtight wood stove and put the sheet metal stove in the basement. After the first snow, I packed some into the stove, later joined by pond ice, and it remained frozen for 4 months, helping me store vegetables away from the bears. We also put in much labor cutting and splitting wood, which was at the limit of my physical capacity on the best of days. After months of effort, we managed to gather about half of what we needed and bought the rest from a neighbor who was a professional. Wood heat is no joke. I was convinced that the quality of the fire used in cooking made a big difference in the effects of the food, and from my experience, it does make a difference, although of unknown origin. We had a little gas range using a bottle of propane, but I preferred wood. I had a little Sierra Zip stove, which is a little camping stove that uses a battery-powered fan to use a little wood or charcoal like a tiny blast furnace. I put it inside a 5-gallon metal can hitched to a stovepipe so I could use it inside. This is one approach to a huge environmental disaster, since something like 1 billion people burn wood or charcoal to cook their meals. Charcoal for cooking was enough to destroy all the trees in Haiti, and with no trees, all kinds of disasters are inevitable. With the Zip stove, I could cook a meal with a couple of pine cones and a few twigs. I started a long series of variations and improvements that continued with some lengthy interruptions for 20 years. At one point, I was using special high-temperature firebox liners, souped-up fan and power supply, and wood pellets and coal for fuel, getting a scorching flame about 2 feet tall. But that was just for fun. In mid-June, exactly 1 year since my piano had been stolen, I went to an estate auction in Keyser Falls, about 15 miles south of Brownfield. I bought an old upright piano for $73, plus $5 to move it to the cabin. The other auction-goers didn't know what to make of my whooping and hollering in celebration that now I could start composing again. Mom sent up a tuning hammer, and I set to work getting the thing up to pitch. After removing the various mouse corpses and nests, I found it impossible to keep from breaking the rusting strings, so finally I relented and hired a local tuner. Then I composed a piano sonata. Next, I worked on my solo violin sonatas, finishing the 21st by early November. This completed the cycle of 64 movements, one for each change of the I Ching. After that, I started 2 years of work on a two-piano piece, The Goldbug Variations. Occasionally, Anton's friends would come by. Connie Kappel ran Vermont Crossroads Press and visited from time to time. We talked about my writing an actually publishable book, maybe about guerrilla agriculture, if I could get something to grow. Connie and Rose were devotees of Charan Singh, a Sikh guru in the lineage of Kirpal Singh. Rose, by the way, had majored in acid and ice cream at Goddard College in Vermont, and, like the rest of us, had no idea what to do for a living. But she did have more sense than most of us, and clearly thought I was a fool with the macrobiotic twaddle. That was a fair assessment, especially when I boiled the watermelon down to a delicious syrup. One day, Connie, Anton, Rose, and another woman came by, and we went out to a local place for dinner. At first, the other woman, whom I'd never met, was quite friendly. I didn't realize that this was a blind date they'd set up for my benefit. At dinner, I started talking a little about my theory and drew a couple of diagrams and equations on a napkin to make things clear. This horrified the woman beyond words. When Rose asked her if she'd like to come back for another visit, she shouted, "Absolutely not!" Later, Anton scolded me for bringing up my work, and I learned not to talk shop. One day, Anton drove Doc up from Cambridge. He was sure we were under surveillance with government agents in the woods which we found amusing. That night, he had nightmares and got up in the wee hours to sit at the kitchen table and smoke cigarettes. As I was trying to sleep just a few feet away, it made me gag, and I asked him to please go outside to smoke. This infuriated him, and after a temper tantrum, he grabbed his stuff and headed out the door. Anton was very angry with me for upsetting Doc, and found him on the road, sputtering in rage. They drove back to Cambridge. That was the last time I saw Doc, since now he was sure I was one of them. I guess someone else would have to monitor the transceiver in his teeth, put there by the CIA dentist that most schizophrenics seem to have. Unbeknownst to me, Anton was selling cocaine, and Doc was right. We were, in fact, under surveillance, but not by UFOs hiding in lenticular clouds. Anton and Rose had a cousin who was about our age. She had been through some severe trauma in her late teens and had been constantly stoned for years. She became mentally ill and now was a gaunt, compulsive cleaner. Visiting our little cabin with its rustic outhouse must have been a great challenge for her. We had a very limited supply of toilet paper, which we used one or two squares at a time. Her first trip to the outhouse lasted about 3 hours, and she had used most of a roll, covering the seat and any other surfaces she would touch. Talking to her was a challenge if you didn't want to talk about staying clean, and quite frankly, I did not. It was a lesson in the power of psychosis. I'm sure plenty of people thought the same way about me and macrobiotics. The garden had very poor soil, and despite my efforts, the plants were stunted. I waited anxiously for the few tiny cobs of Indian corn to ripen. But I had no fence, and there was plenty of wildlife. The local raccoons knew just when the corn would be harvested, and a couple of days before the corn was ready, they knocked down every plant and took one bite from each cob. What the coons didn't get, the deer finished off. Nature won this round. Ice Age. In the early fall, a cheerful, burly fellow named Bear joined me at the farm. He had been through 3 main winters living in the woods in a birch bark wigwam. He made everything he owned, including all his clothing, which was mostly from deer he'd killed, skinned, and tanned with their own brains. He set up his wigwam down by the lake, a few hundred yards from the cabin. The wigwam was a circular dome about 9 feet in diameter and about 7 feet at the peak, which had a small hole to let the smoke out. In the center was a fire pit, and he built a pipe of old cans that let fresh air directly into the pit from the outside. Next to the pit was his bed made of dry spruce boughs. Note that birch bark is one of nature's most effective tinders, so flammable that it can burn under snow. I wondered that he hadn't gone up in flames long ago. The constant smoke impregnated itself into everything he owned, which helped kill bacteria and covered the stench from irregular bathing. When the snow came in force, his wigwam was nothing more than a small bump in the drifts, with smoke drifting up. Bear was physically up to the rigors of life in the woods in ways that I could never be with my arthritis, and also had many skills from long practice. He made wire snares for rabbits, which were remarkably effective. One day on the mountain, I came across a small cave where a porcupine hid. I let Bear know, and next day he went up and dispatched the animal with a spear. After skinning, he put it on a spit and roasted what he termed the scrumptious critter. The quills went into decorative patterns on his clothing, and the cold lake water served as refrigerator. I decided not to tell him of other wildlife unless he got very hungry indeed. From his example and my experience, reality dictated that just gathering was not going to work in a hunter-gatherer lifestyle, especially in a cold climate. We relied on the lake for bathing as long as it was possible, following the Cartesian principle, I stink, therefore I swim. This led to the inevitable contest of who would be the last to jump in. First snow was at the end of October, and about then little fringes of ice formed on the edges each morning. Jumping into that water was a freakish experience, almost like little volcanoes going off all over my skin. Despite my emaciation and arthritis, and his substantial heft, I won this little contest, which probably made me all the more stiff. There were many abandoned wild apple trees from long ago, when there were orchards here and there. Bear brought large burlap bags filled with hundreds of pounds of downed apples. We sliced them and strung apple rings with thread along the rafters to dry. This was a major part of our diet for the winter. As the weather turned cold, the wall of windows that replaced our porch was a big disadvantage. I used blankets to hold about a foot-thick layer of crumpled newspapers all along that wall, making the place much gloomier, but far warmer. Still, heat was a major challenge. I wanted the running water from the well to continue as long as possible, so when I went to Dad's place over Thanksgiving, I left a little drip going in the two large stainless sinks. These were from big kitchens originally, so were each about 2 feet deep and about the same size square. When I got back, the sinks were two very large ice cubes, and the floor was a skating rink. In a little while, the frost was 6 feet deep, so the pipe, which was 4 feet down, froze as well. From then on, water came from melted snow and lake ice. This meant that bathing and laundry were extremely difficult. I took a sponge bath every couple of weeks, whether I needed it or not, and did little laundry for at least 3 months. I would track snow in, and a day later, sweep it out. Frequently, it was impossible to get the temperature above freezing below my knees, unless close to the stove. I wore my main hunting boots with half-inch felt plus thick wool socks for almost 6 months. We had some neighbors who set me up with a job house-sitting for a couple who were going to Hawaii for their honeymoon from December 7th through January 10th. They lived in the center of the Ossipee Mountains in New Hampshire in a winterized mobile home way off in the woods, and had a dog who needed company. This would pay $300, which was about what I had spent since leaving work last April. Before that started, I headed down to visit with Dad for Thanksgiving, especially as he was about to have an operation for a hiatal hernia. Shortly after my arrival, I had a severe attack of arthritis that left me in agony. I could only walk backwards, leaning on a mop handle. Dad was freaked out. I couldn't reach my feet, so Dad had to help dress me and get me into bed. We rented crutches, and I spent hours in steaming bathwater. John and Jackie came from Western Massachusetts, and we joined with Mom in a restaurant. This was the largest gathering of our family since the early 70s, although Wakanda was in Colorado. I had wanted us to get together and try and have some decent relations. My parents clearly despised each other, and John didn't want to hear Dad's lectures. I appeared to them to be quite foolish, being a self-styled expert in alternative medicine, while getting sicker and sicker, and now hobbling on crutches. This was our last gathering. I tried once again eating more widely, and after several days of turkey, had recovered enough to walk, leaning heavily on a cane. We went to see a doctor who was an old family friend, now converted from Unitarian to Sufism. He used homeopathy and other alternative methods, although still running his conventional practice. He said I had rheumatoid arthritis, still a misdiagnosis, and gave me some diluted toxin of poison ivy. It didn't help. I borrowed Anton's old Volvo station wagon, which he let me use for the cost of the insurance. This made the house-sitting job possible. When I got to the property, I had to use my hands to lift my legs out of the car and onto the snow. The couple had never met me in person, and when the man saw me do this, he told his wife loudly enough for me to hear that I was too sick to stay there and they should get someone else. I pleaded with them to let me have the job, and they relented. Then off they flew to Hawaii. The mobile home was heavily insulated and had a large wood stove. They built a sauna between the house and a creek that flowed fast enough to never freeze. The couple were members of Arika, yet another cult, and had much literature for me to gawk at during my stay. They had coloring books for the various spirits they were supposed to visualize in meditation and commune with, which looked a lot like tarot card illustrations, only much sillier. Lots of swords and flames and skimpy dresses on well-endowed cartoon bodies. The husband was a dentist, and you'd think with all that nitrous oxide around, he could have done better. I preferred reading Churchill's History of World War II, which prompted me to have dreams of my body at war. To turn over, I sent a telegram to the General of the Knees. That Christmas, and for 3 weeks following, we had a record cold spell. It never got above 10 below in the day, and got down to 30 below regularly at night, all over inland New England. I did quite a few saunas as hot as I could stand, dashing outside to test the limits of endurance. The creek froze over for the first time ever, which was a challenge since that was my drinking water. I had to wear goggles outdoors, as exposing my eyes to the air made vision very difficult. To see what the eastern front was like, I tried firing a .22 rifle, and it was almost impossible to hit anything. Not far from the house, a construction crew was building a barn, even in these conditions. I could hardly believe it, and invited them over for a sauna. The couple returned from Hawaii and immediately threw wood in the stove. I had to strip down to my long johns and collapsed prostrate on the floor. Then I checked the thermometer. It was 100 degrees, and they didn't even notice. Yes, I wanted to go to India, but not right this second. I returned to Brownfield in mid-January and kept the car 2 miles from the cabin with my nearest neighbors. Bear and I snowshoed through the woods, visiting some people on the other side of the mountain who lived in a cave, very snug and comfortable. He then left for Ellsworth on the coast. I started copying parts for the Bhagavad Gita cantata, which was a mammoth task taking months back in the days of pen and ink. My health continued to deteriorate despite every effort, including periodic fasts, and even some aspirin and vitamin pills. I started having spatial disorientation due to prolonged darkness and lighting from kerosene lanterns. During the cold snap, the ice on the lake got to 1.5 feet thick. Locals came by to ice fish and didn't catch anything. They left their spare minnows for me, which I boiled and ate, treating them as freshwater sardines. Yum! The winter was getting to me, and I was worried about money once again. Since Thanksgiving, I could only play violin from time to time, sometimes not for a month. I had not solved any of the practical problems of my life and saw no end to the suffering. Suicide sounded like a viable option. Hunting the wild algae. I saw the name Maine Coast Sea Vegetables on a package of seaweed and dropped them a postcard asking for employment and a place to stay. Shep and Lynette Earhart were macrobiotic also, and most graciously accepted. I tobogganed down the mountain at the end of March, dug my car out of 5 feet of snow, and did laundry for the first time since January 7th. Anton and a neighbor I'll call Ernie helped get my stuff from the cabin, as I could not walk back uphill. Ernie's wife had just left with their infant daughter, leaving behind a 4-year-old son, whom I'm sure was distressed, as he was still breastfeeding. I could sympathize, as I was never properly weaned myself. With no girlfriend, I could not properly complete the withdrawal. Anton was having a drama of his own, as he was out on bail after arrest by a couple of drunken DEA agents, and at first was facing 75 years. The whole scene in Waitsfield, Vermont, where he lived when not in Brownfield, was in turmoil as a result. Thankfully, the cops' incompetence led them to charge him with selling 15,000 hits of acid, which he hadn't done. They'd give him immunity to the person who did sell the acid, who then confessed. So they were left with a measly conspiracy charge after $400,000 and a year's work on the case. I drove to Franklin, Maine, not far from Bar Harbor and Mount Desert Island, at the head of Frenchman's Bay. This is some of the most scenic coastline in America, and a spectacular place to sail. My first duty was to not smell like I had been in the woods for a year, which took 2 days of bathing to remedy. The seaweed season had just started, so even with some snow flurries in the air, I put on lots of wool, clambered into waders, and strode out to hook some kelp. Somehow, I managed to scramble around on rocks covered with seaweed at low tide in nearly freezing water. This was a wonderful way to make a living, and I enjoyed being out in nature, finding food in such a harmless way that was good for people to eat. But this could only go on for so long before the arthritis got the upper hand. The Earharts were satsangis, devotees of Ajab Singh, who taught Surat Shabd Yoga and was a disciple of Kirpal Singh. They had pictures of their spiritual master all over the house and had been to the temple in India. They tended to associate primarily with other satsangis of their guru, which made their acceptance of me into their home rather remarkable. As there were very few American followers, maybe a few dozen, this made their life socially isolated. But they had the one true guru, and only other satsangis of their group were going to get enlightened. They had little other logical choice than isolation. I admired their taking spiritual evolution so seriously, but I couldn't join a group that saw itself as the only effective path. I regaled the Earharts with sailing tales, true and enhanced, and they agreed that they had the perfect setup for having a sailboat. I found out that Kentucky had been partially taken apart and stored in a garage for the last 8 years and was for sale cheap, not terribly far away. They bought it and then risked the transmission of their new Volkswagen Rabbit towing it home. I spent several weeks putting it back together. They renamed it Alaria after a seaweed we harvested. After talking with Grandma and old friends in Denton, I applied to go back to school at NTSU. Since this was for vocational training, I figured on studying physics, math, and computers, which vocational rehabilitation would help pay for. There were challenges getting in-state tuition and other details to deal with over the spring and summer, but Grandma would send some money to get me down there and start it up in school. Rita Field is a chiropractor in Cambridge who had a second home near the Earharts and was a regular visitor. She took one look at me and knew exactly what the problem was. She gave me the critical advice to apply for supplemental security income from Social Security, which I didn't know about and should have done years before. This would include Medicaid and enough money to pay for basic needs, plus food stamps. I got on the phone right away. In those days, it took several months to qualify, but the process was basically fair. Soon after this, Reagan changed the rules so that everyone was automatically denied and had to go through a long process of appeal while hiring a lawyer. Thousands of disabled people were left without benefits, and many committed suicide. Eventually, the Supreme Court found this to be illegal, and the application process went back to what it had been. But this cost the government money, since viable applicants were no longer giving up or dying before payments started. So, a few years later, once again, all applicants were automatically denied and required appeals. This time, no lawyers thought they could make any money fighting the cause, and the situation remains to this day, despite the existing court ruling. The power of money is just too formidable. It can take up to 3 years to get approved for SSI, even with an obvious case, and the benefit is now too low to live on. We launched Elaria in mid-June in Sorrento, at the head of Frenchman's Bay, and a week later moved our mooring over to the other side of Scudic Peninsula to Bunker's Harbor. We could now use the sailboat as a mother ship for an inflatable dinghy and seaweed harvesting. I wanted to live on the boat, but there was no way to pull that off. After a few weeks of boating, I was exhausted and realized that my body just couldn't take the strain. After a particularly hard day on the water, I had a sore throat for a week, then a high fever. When the fever broke, I had an extraordinary vision of Ajaib Singh. First, he stepped on my foot, which felt like a massive electric shock, and surprised the hell out of me. Then I saw what they referred to as the light form for a bit. After that subsided, I asked him a question about the path of the masters, which has many features I don't accept. He said three things that are basic to my not becoming an initiate. I am the only perfect master on the earth. I am the only one unstained by call. None shall come to the Father but through me. Up to now, he had been full of light, and it was a blissful experience. But as soon as he said these things, the lights went out, and he appeared to be completely mundane. He also advised me to change my brand of shampoo. When I related this to Shep and Lynette, they were delighted, as they had not had visions of their guru. While I thought the story as I told it would be a cautionary tale and a reason to step back from total devotion, they saw it as proof that their guru was in fact the only true master. Oh well. One day, coming into our little harbor, I'd forgotten to raise the retractable keel made of heavy steel plate. We hit a rock and came off sideways. Next time out, the boat was more tender than usual. Turns out, we'd torn the steel plate off and left it on a rock. Shep and friends retrieved the keel, and we pulled the boat for repairs. I started composing the Goldbug variations again, this time on their old upright they stored in the barn. Anton came by. He'd beaten the 75 years, but was convicted of conspiracy and was waiting the next 6 weeks on bail for sentencing. One day, some friends came by with a woman in her early 20s who was staying with them for a little while. Her host introduced us by saying, "Dear, I'd like you to meet Bill Robinson." I extended my hand, and she recoiled in horror. Turns out, she didn't touch men. she had been introduced to me as Dear because she didn't have a name, those being part of the patriarchal hegemony. She was on her way to live at a lesbian separatist community where all the buildings were built by women, thus avoiding the contamination of male architectural vibrations. Meanwhile, quite unknown to me at the time, Dorothy was assigned a devotee husband down at the ISKCON Temple in Dallas. This fellow was from Wisconsin and had no experience with women at all, and had been a brahmachari for some years. They could not have been less suited for one another. He bought the cult party line and thought that sex was acceptable only when the man demanded it for making children. Soon after marriage, they were assigned to live in Fiji, where there is a substantial Indian population. While there, Dorothy found herself doing missionary work in the interior jungle, trying to convince people one generation removed from cannibalism to eat no meat of any kind and to worship a strange blue-skinned god from India. One older woman came up and squeezed her thigh and said something in a native language. The others grinned, but were shy about translating. The woman was sizing her up as possible dinner. Dorothy gave birth to her daughter there and painted a large mural for the temple. Under great stress, she returned to the U.S. and left ISKCON. Her husband decided to leave also in order to preserve the marriage, and they settled in Wisconsin with his family. I was examined by doctors as part of my application for SSI and finally got a solid diagnosis of ankylosing spondylitis. Now I could go look up information about what I had. None of my friends in macrobiotics had ever heard of this kind of arthritis. Anton asked me to sign an affidavit to present in court swearing that he had no involvement in drugs. I thought this was true, but of course it was not. Although I brought this matter up from time to time over the next few decades, he has never apologized for this breach of faith. In August, I boarded the dreaded bus for 3 days and returned to school at NTSU.